there is an added challenge with that wealth identity, and it creates actually insecurity, because you most of the time we build relationship with people is through revealing who we are. Hey, I just told you who I am, where I'm from, and what I did. But that comes with a consequence when you're a wealthy person.
Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, a financial advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services.
And I'm Jess DeBear, Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, I have a feeling we're going to sink our teeth into some juicy family stories today, because joining us is Liam McCormick, Executive Director and Senior Strategist of UBS's Family Advisory and Philanthropy Services Americas team. Buckle up, folks. This is going to be a good one.
Listeners, let's see who's stopping by.
Who's your favorite Brit?
Who's my favorite Brit? Well, Harry Styles came to mind immediately when you asked that, but I don't know why.
Because he's delicious.
Not because of that.
I think it is, Doug. You can say it. Most men think that.
No.
He's pretty delicious.
I don't know. He's a talented guy, actor, singer. I mean.
Doesn't take life too seriously.
I'm sure you thought about this. Who is your favorite Brit?
I love me some Adele. She's a saucy Brit. She's not refined. Should I bust out my British accent today?
I think you have to go. You should try to go as far as you can with the British accent in the whole thing. In fact, every question you ask, you should try to do a different type of British accent. Mm.
Right, you know, because you have your proper royal, and then you have your Cockney. Give me some bangers and mash.
You know why they call them bangers?
Is the bangers the bean part?
No.
The banger is the sausage part?
Yep.
No.
Yeah.
Is it that kind?
No. It's okay. Has to do with World War II and rationing. And so they put more water in the sausages to kind of, fatten them up. And so when they would heat them, if they heated them too much, the water would explode the sausage and bang.
That was
why they were called bangers. Yeah.
You know some random things.
I do. All right. So Jess, we have a unique guest today.
Mm-hmm.
He's for a financially related podcast. He's our first guest who's actually working in the world of money. And he's an employee of UBS. So we don't have to do as many disclaimers as we normally do.
That's right.
And I'll tell you how we met our guest. Jessica and I were preparing for a meeting in Chicago with a client of ours. And as soon as we heard our guest's voice, we thought, we're texting each other. Hey, we got to have this guy. He's got to stop by. So today we have Liam McCormick of UBS's Family Advisory and Philanthropy Services America's team. Of course, America's team. Liam works with families in helping them understand their relationship with money, values, and philanthropic intent. He guides families through wealth transition, family governance, and philanthropy, and helps them develop cohesive strategies to bridge generations and build legacy. Prior to joining UBS, Liam worked with a number of international organizations, including Habitat for Humanity, Opportunity International UK, and the Prince's Trust. He is a former British Army officer, and he's found himself on the rugby field a time. We know you'll find him as charming as we do. Please, ladies and gentlemen, meet Liam McCormick.
Yeah. Wow. That, one of those introductions you listen to and go, gosh, is that me? And is that what I do? But thank you. I think my father would have been very proud of that introduction, and my mother would be raising her eyebrows going, he's a very naughty boy.
All right. I have to kick it off, Doug, because I have a burning question right off the bat. Who is your favorite Bond?
Oh,
let's get down to the nitty gritty here.
Yeah, my favorite
Bond. Who's the best Bond?
I guess I grew up with Roger Moore. So I'd probably say him. He had that kind of, slick, slightly tongue in cheek you know, not too serious. The others were a bit more. Mm-hmm. I'd say him.
All right. Making a note. All right. Well, thank you. I wanted to just make sure we got that one out of the way today. All right. Take it away, Doug.
So as many of our listeners can attest, we're not exactly dealing with the Southern Belle here. Prior to working with us here at UBS, your journey started with the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. So how does a British Army officer find his way to the Southern Atlanta, Georgia, USA?
Well, the short answer is that I married a beautiful American young lady. The longer answer was that I went into the British Army. To be honest, believe it or not, I had no military history whatsoever, but it was a time, this was in the 90s, you know, the world was a pretty safe place, if I'm honest, you know, the Cold War was over, there was nothing happening in the Middle East, and I spent the first few years of my life playing a lot of rugby, and I took over a platoon, I was an infantry, so I took over a platoon of 30 guys, you know, and I was 24 years old. And if some of these guys were 17, because he could join at 16 back in the day. Yeah, and they're young people. And then some of them were 34 years old, had been around for a long time. And they're looking at me going, what do you know about, you know, any of this?
Yeah.
And so it was a short, sharp leadership experience, I guess, but working there. And I think when I look back on it, it was one of those things that, you know, some of the soldiers there were, but a lot of the soldiers from very, very challenging backgrounds. And actually, it was the first time in their lives that they had money in their pockets, that each, you know, every 2 weeks they got paid. And the platoon I took over, but I discovered one of the soldiers there, every payday, he went out and bought himself a white jacket for, you know, $250. But within a week, he'd run out of money. So he needed more. So he sold it to one of his mates for 50 quid just to go and drink money, you know, to get some drink money and the rest of it. So slowly the whole platoon were getting these jackets, and he realized that people's, you know, you become a father is probably too strong a word, but they have a pastoral responsibility to these guys. And you go, you know, you sort of doing that. And that sort of set me on this journey of working with young folk, having these leadership roles, going through my military career. And I met Christina about when I was a young captain, I guess. Actually, I was changing the guards at Buckingham Palace. It was one of the jobs we did. I was there, and I'd met Christina the day before, a week before, and I said, look, next week I'm going to be changing the guards at Buckingham Palace. Would you like to come for lunch? Afterwards, you can come for lunch.
And nice.
She said, yeah.
That is a baller move right there. What a line.
Yeah, so yeah, she said yes, and she will tell you to this day that it's been downhill from there. when I left the army, we had been in England for a long time. We'd moved around a lot of the places, and Christina is then in education. She got an opportunity basically to come to Atlanta, and there's another link in there actually. When I made the transition out of the army, you mentioned the Prince's Trust. I went to work for the Prince's Trust, or was consulted with them, and they were co-located next to UBS in London. So next, the Prince's Trust was here, and the UBS office was right next door. And I was trying to raise money for a program. And here are these bankers next door. Let's go and get some money from them. And through that, you know, when I moved here, UBS were expanding their team.
Now, a lot of these things, you're in the family and philanthropy world here at UBS. Seems like that has been a theme throughout your life. Mm. Was that something you sought out or sort of fell into?
Definitely fell into. You know, I was in the infantry. I was doing all this good stuff. And I had an opportunity while I was still serving. So the Prince's Trust is a youth organization in the UK. And at the time, it was Prince Charles, now King Charles, his main charity, helping 16 to 24-year-olds and, you know, from really difficult backgrounds. And they've kind of, because they've got no qualifications, they've been left behind on the slag. They were called not NEETs, which stood for not in employment, education, or training. So they're defined by what they're not what they could be. And I was asked to go, I was seconded to them to say, could you go and help? They have a 12-week program. We want to bring, it's a leadership, self-confidence course. Could you help bring some, you know, I'd been working in helping train young officers. I've been doing a training role. At the time, it was in Afghanistan. So I was training these guys for Afghanistan. And they said, could you, I'd love to do something different. So I went in there and I was, you know, found myself with these young people, very much like the soldiers I'd been leading, the same kind of background. And one of the things I noticed is that if you live in a world devoid of praise or devoid of role models that can show you the way, one word or one example can be really powerful. So when you're on, you know, you're taking them on, yeah. Some of these kids lived up in urban cities, yet a few miles, there was a big hill. They'd seen that hill every single day of their lives, but they'd never been up it. So we take them, I can't possibly do this, it's too hard, you know. We've got to the top, looking over the top, and they go, wow, that's amazing. So it didn't take much to capture them in terms of what they could do. And then saying, you can do this, you're capable of doing this. That was a pivotal as a consultant. So anyway, it was a great program, but it needs money. I was increasingly going out and asking people for money. So that led me to UBS, but also exposed me to the world of ultra high net worth families, because I worked with a number of families who were funding this for us. And so It sort of, it wasn't a direction I was going to do this. It was a necessity. But, and then in that space, when I was doing that, a couple of the clients I was working with, the donors said, look, you're doing this with these young people. I've got some young people who've got some difficulties as well. They've got all of the opportunity in the world. Can you help them with some character development, some, you know, self-confidence? I said, and, you know, I'll give it a go, was the answer. So I started doing that at the same time.
You had a chance to speak to these disadvantaged youth. And if you believed in them, if you could teach them things, if you could talk to them, the power of that kind of message is important. Like, and then the amount of confidence that you're given just by someone else believing, it's probably one of the most powerful things you can do for somebody.
I'm sure if you cast your mind back and pivotal moments in your life, it will be someone speaking into your life and saying along those lines, you were seen. So being seen as a young person is really important, particularly in that teenage years when you're trying to find your own identity. So being seen and being known. We all have that need. And so the importance of an adult, someone in your life. I remember I was a pretty average student, you know, and we talked about rugby. We'd get given our report card at the end of each term. It was in a sealed envelope. And I read through it, and the rugby guy said, Liam is a tower of strength on the rugby field. And no one had ever said that to me. And I went back and looked at it. And I thought, wow. So, you know, and I think that one line, when I reflect on it, you know, transformed me, because I had an area of strength and it enabled me to be that in other areas as well. Because one person that saw something in you, the people in and around us, when we see young people doing things, staying it and seeing them is transformational, particularly, and this, you know, in the community that we work with. If you think about young people in wealthy families, they live in a shadow of a great man or woman who has created wealth. And it's very hard to step out of that shadow, and it creates actually insecurity, because you most of the time we build relationship with people is through revealing who we are. Hey, I just told you who I am, where I'm from, and what I did. But that comes with a consequence when you're a wealthy person. If you say, you know, my dad is so-and-so, people go, oh,
yeah,
we know who you are. Mm-hmm. Well, you must have had an easy life.
You find that when you're moving from one world to another, are you energized by young people? Do you love just connecting with them? Is that where you really target these relationships, or do you try to teach the parents to help their kids understand?
I am energized by that because I've seen the potential, but I enjoy it. It's particularly with families, for parents as well. A lot of the stuff that we do with in the family advising philanthropy is not prescriptive. We don't say, this is how you parent. We are descriptive. We say, these are the things which are really useful when you're in this environment. Good communication. You need to communicate with the kids. And what does good communication look like? You know, how do we make good decisions with each other? How do we involve our children? What are the what are the characteristics of families that are successful with wealth? And so they're more descriptive. And so I feel like we're giving them the tools to be better parents, but also have successful families. We often talk about values. And if the values that we say we are aren't replicated in the culture of the family, so what is the culture of the family? Do you give? You know, do you give up your time? It's very difficult not to break away from that model because you haven't seen anything else. You know, the husband and wife that you will probably be will either be a replication of what your parents were, or something completely different because you knew they got it completely wrong. I'm not going to be that.
That's an overcorrection. Talk about how, you know, what you're doing at UBS for these families. I mean, you touched on it a little bit, but sort of, do you go into family situations and with the whole family have sit down?
Or do you have folks that have that feel like their teenagers have gone off the rails, and what do we do? How do we like rein them in?
I think it's probably best to talk in generalities and look at sort of what are the archetypes of families we deal with. And so on the family advisory side, the most common thing we're dealing with now, there's a lot of clients who are probably in their 80s, 70s or 80s. And, you know, they've amassed wealth of, you know, really significant wealth. A lot of the clients we deal with, you know, have inherited a family business or and I say small, you know, mom and pop shop or something like that. They've built these things up and they've sold it for somewhere between, you know, 50 and 150 million, depending on, you know, the scale of which they've achieved that. And that business has been the focus of, and they may have done that 20 years ago. And since then, they've invested that money and it's gone even bigger because they have spendthrift. They weren't spendy, you know, people. The children are aware that there's money because, you know, you've got a house in Florida, you know, you've got a house, you know, in the mountains, you might have a lake house, and the lifestyle that you live, you don't need to be that. And you know, we had this event, but what they don't often know is how that wealth has grown since the liquidity event. When we're talking about children, we're talking about 50 and 60 year olds. They know there's wealth, but there's been no conversation about the money coming down or no conversation about what's going to happen to it. They don't know how big it is. The generational disconnect between the baby boomers who worked hard, had a different kind of work ethic. There's often a sense of disappointment or disapproval with the following generation because they haven't worked as hard, or their perception of hard work was staying in the office and never coming home and doing all the work. The next generation have a work ethic, but they also have work balance. And so, I never saw my dad. I don't want that for my children. And so I'm making different choices, but there's a disconnect between those two generations. And what we do often is bring that gap together. So bring by speaking to all of the family who are, you know, there are some challenges, particularly if there are estranged relationships, because some family members don't want anything to do with it. But so it's never about compulsion. It's about choice. And every time I've had a conversation with a family the other day, and, you know, the parents going, well, I'm not sure they really want to be involved. They've never asked us. But I go, okay, let me speak to the kids. I speak to the kids who are in their 50s and go, well, they've made it very clear they don't want us. It's their money. It's not mine. I don't want to transgress.
So that everybody's making wrong assumptions.
Correct. Exactly right. So the problem when there's a void, a vacuum, people make assumptions. They make assumptions and they're often wrong. So part of that process is bringing them together. So actually, that's quite bridgeable. And they do want to know. They do want to, but they don't know how to ask. They don't want to feel entitled. The common challenge is when they sell the business, the family had a cohesion around that business in terms of, even if you weren't part of the business, when we got together, they said, how's the business going? What's happening? Is so-and-so still there? Everyone knows everybody, and the business, and it creates this conversation around the dinner table, and it creates an identity, particularly in a community. The business is sold. It's replaced with a huge amount of money. But what are we here for now? We don't talk about that anymore. There's no, you know, none of us are working together. We all have our different funds. And so there can be a sort of a very natural, most families, if you think about what's the natural progression for families is you get married, you have children, and you're preparing your children to be independent. to go out and do it again. Whereas wealth and businesses are help them stay together. There's a reason to be together because you're getting disbursements and this family enterprise. But when that goes away, it's not there. So trying to help families find kind of a purpose for the wealth. What are we going to do with this money? Do we want to stay as family? Is that important to us? Because every family I work with, if they're not intentional, they may have got really healthy families, but healthy families are not lucky families. There's an intentionality about that, how they are together. You know, they value time together, they prioritize it. All these little things help families be healthy, and particularly with wealth, because once that, if the parents are the glue that holds the family, when they're not there, people go, well, you know, they're not the one organizing. You know, we all love going on holiday with our parents without paying for it. You know, if I've got to pay for it.
You know. Absolutely.
Yeah. So
you know, I'm going with your parents.
Yeah. So anyway, that I don't know if that answers the question, but that's some of the stuff that we deal with and try and facilitate.
That's really so, and that sounds like a lot of stuff. It's a lot of meetings, a lot of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what do we charge for services like that, Liam?
Good question. Mm. So the way I never say it's free because it's not, because we work with, so we do have a minimum. We tend to work with families who are 50 million and above. And obviously working with UBS, they're paying some pretty good fees to us. And it's part of that service. If you come to UBS, part of that service is family advisory. We have, you know, access to really high quality attorneys. We have access to, right, you know, portfolio advisory teams, all of the things which the lifestyle that comes and the challenges that come with private, maybe a family office. You know, we are, a family office to those families, and it is part of the service of being a UBS client.
So a lot of the professionals in our field, they have a view of money that is a little more nuanced than the average Joe. So tell us a little bit more about what money specifically means to you. And I also would love to know what your earliest memory surrounding money is.
Ah, do you know what? My first memory of money was... You know, I guess I grew up in a middle class family, so I didn't, you know, I never really came across it. The only time I really ever saw it was we used to go to church, and Dad, when the collection would come round, would put he'd always put a crisp note in the collection tin. I was like, well, no, that was what I saw. That you know, as you talk about habits, you saw them doing that, and I was always, and then it come to me, and I look at this big bag full of money, like. You know, do I put my hand in and take it? And so I think that was the first memory of money. I think the first time I got a real appreciation for money was, again, this is why I always remind, it doesn't matter what background from, earning money is a real, and I went and worked in a summer, I went and worked in a kitchen washing dishes, and that was hard work. And I got a bit of extra money. And it was, I used to enjoy it because I was in a kitchen. It was a high end kitchen. And so I used to love when the patisserie saucepans would come in with always lovely chocolate sauce and eating a bit and probably sounds
fairly festive.
Yeah. And so, but I learned how hard it was to earn a dollar. That was a really important part for me as well. Learning the value. And one of the things we often speak to families about is money culture. So what is quite hard to change is your money culture. And so we're talking about different generations that are coming up. So they've earned their money. They've done it. It's very difficult to not be spendthrift. You looking at those things. If you've been touched in that, it's very hard not to be. I guess, you know, for me, wealth has, you know, as I've gone up through those cycles, even as a young officer, money enabled me to do things. It bought me time to do other things. And so, that has been one of the main, obviously with education, the rest of it creates opportunity. But the main thing for me is the more money you have, and you can pay for a cleaner. You could, you know, do all these other things that creates more time. But then what you do with that time is probably what's important. And as I mentioned as well, seeing being a person of the world, seeing what a dollar does in different parts of the world is also impactful, because you realize that, you know, just by living, most people, if you live in the United States, you're already in the top 5% of wealthiest people in the world. I mean, that's the reality of it. You know, I think what's the poverty line is like $1.80 a day. So, you know, that's what poverty is. And so when you go and see that, it also gives you appreciation of what you can do with wealth as well.
Lyndon, we always have to remind clients, you're allowed to have a little fun, right? You're only one time.
Yes.
Having some fun's okay.
But I think that is the point, actually. It's a good point in terms of, and it's what is really hard with a lot of clients is the financial finish line, you know, and what are you working towards in terms of, you know, if you have a plan and you're putting things in, so you go, actually, we're building towards this. And that's one of the things I find difficult about this role, particularly as I'm talking about the generations we're in. And I'm not judgmental. I try not to be judgmental. What you do with your wealth is up to you to some degree, whether you want to give it away or not. But, you know, you've got a lot of money. You're not spending, you're never going to spend, but there's an anxiety around that. Are my children going to use it badly? Is someone going to rob her? You know, there's all these anxieties, but actually let it go. Let it flow. You've got enough for you either give it to the next generation, do something positive with it, or just give it to the tax man and do it while you're alive. That's one of the things I think in my money culture, is because you can really bless people. You can have, but knowing what your goal is, because the temptation is we get there and go, well, maybe I need to, it is never actually, it sounds like I'm preaching, but a lot of clients, they're just good at making money. They're good at doing it. And so it's not that they desire it. They just know how to do it. And so it's part of their identity. So helping them think through those lines as well. You've crossed that line. You can keep doing it, but what do you want to do with it?
We like those clients that are good at making.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
Yeah, we'll talk to those people.
Succession, big popular tell. Yellowstone, Arrested Development. Yeah. Wealthy families. It's a topic du jour in dramas. Is it truth? Is it reality? Do we see those types of themes play out? Are there stories that you've run across that are stranger than some of this fiction?
Look, they're there for a reason. Those stories are there for a reason. So I think you can see families have the same dynamics with no money involved. It's not just about wealth and the challenges of, you know, people squabbling over, falling out. You see people going to court over relatively small amounts. And one of the families I dealt with that, you know, had phenomenal wealth, and they fought over something that had no value at all, but it had lots of emotional value. The challenge is not always about money. And so often the challenges that we face are seeded by our parents, not intentionally, but lack of communication, saying, well, actually, I love you, and if that's what you choose to do, I'm going to give you the freedom. Most gifts, the most powerful gifts, are no strings attached. You want it, off you go. Go and do that. But we rarely do that. The reality is it's very common. And I can think of a number of situations where you know, I've been in similar places where the children have actually decided to opt out. You know, dad, you've made all this wealth, you've done all these things, but I don't want the control. I don't want all of that. And so I'm just not going to engage in any of this. And then there's somebody else who's, you know, the eldest son who's in there loyally slaving away doing that. And then everyone's treated equally, and they kind of go, well, hang on a minute. You've had nothing to do with this. I've been here taking your dad's nonsense, and yet we're all getting the same amount. That's not fair. So one of the things we talk, you know, try and help families think about to try and avoid those scenarios, because you say they are common, is that if everyone understands the rules of the game before you start playing it, you know what the rules are. Mm-hmm. If you participate in the business, we're going to split the business, the value, three ways. But if you participate in it, then you will also participate in the growth and the wealth creation. So then you kind of have a knowing choice. It's hard to then later go, well, that's not fair because we agreed to that. So helping people understand the rules, because if we know the rules, when we play sport, we all know what the rules are. So we can dispute whether he was offside or onside or whatever it is, but we know what the rules are and what we're playing. So when the outcome gets there, we might not be happy with it because we lost, we didn't play the game well, but we can't say it's not fair because we all played by the same rules.
Because we were upfront at the start. We talked about it at the start. We were communicating about it from the beginning. We weren't just making assumptions and just going along.
Yes, yeah. Very much so. So, I mean, one of the questions I sometimes ask clients is when we're doing this, and they're kind of, because they're often on the fence, I'm not sure if I want to talk to my children about this. I don't really want to engage. I ask them, so what are you afraid of if you don't do anything? If you do nothing, what are you worried might happen? Mm. And they go, and they know that, and they know the answer to that question. Sometimes they'll say something like, well, my kids, they don't have the grit. They don't have what I have to run the business or to do that. And the next question, the good question is, okay, that's fair enough. But what have you done to prepare them?
Mm. No. Snap.
Yeah. Snap. Yeah. Snap. And then they go, then the next question is, okay, so what should I do? And what should I do? Yeah. For not being something, which we've played a part in them being, helping our clients have a clearer view of their role and what they can do. And it's not the end of the road. We have so many resources and courses and opportunities for young people to connect, to learn and help them be involved and hopefully avoid some of the pitfalls. Rather than look at focusing on the negative, this terrible thing might happen. What about what can you do? What's the opportunity? What can you do with this? You've got an amazing, you can do everything and nothing. So how can I help you, make the most of your life? And we have some amazing clients who've done some amazing things with their wealth, whether it's through philanthropy, investing, social impact, all sorts of things. So I would always try and rather than dwell on the negative things because they're pretty easy to find, but there's obviously lots of families who are doing this well, who are, I work with a 7th, 8th, 9th generation family, the people who've done this phenomenally well as well. I say phenomenally well, they've done well, but there are bumps in the road.
Yeah. There's always bumps in the road.
Thank you, Liam, because a lot of what you talked about today is not just for, higher net worth folks. It's for everybody, really. I mean, it's guys trying to figure out the whole parent gig. The thing I'll take away, and I love that you said, is that we are all just broken timber. And crooked timber. And so like stress of any kind, whether it be financial, emotional, can create those cracks. So it's a really good lesson, Liam. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for being gracious with your time and sharing with our listeners. And thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for listening.
This is fantastic. Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to go back to my British tabloids now. I got to go.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.